the way in the state of our industry today is we're just getting by. Let's be honest. The numbers aren't that great. The outcomes, we can't even decide on what the outcomes need to be. And my big question to the industry is why? Like, just think it, the problem is ever evolving. And yet we don't seem to really be listening to what's happening well enough to address it and to actually help more people.
As the healthcare industry evolves, how can treatment professionals turn off the noise and really listen to emerging trends, to their patients, and to themselves? I'm David Kondos, and we'll dive into this with Connection Coach James Hadlock on this episode of Recovery Unscripted.
My father was an addict. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My half-brother and father both committed suicide. So it's about telling them, you know, Miss Tennessee didn't always have a perfect life.
All human pain, no matter who you are, we have one pill to take care of it all. That's insane. We're going to look back in 50 years and think the entire country was deluded to think that that would work.
I'm not just coming at you from a law enforcement side. I come at it because I have a family member who still struggles.
I faced a lot of problems, but one thing I didn't do is give up. That's what I want people to hear is do not ever give up. There's hope out there.
Sharing firsthand stories and expert insights from the front lines of behavioral and mental health care. This is Recovery Unscripted.
I'm here with James Hadlock. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Absolutely. So let's start with your story. I know it sounds like you got some crazy stuff. So let's start
there. We're going to jump right in, huh? Yeah. So I'm getting ready to turn 50 years old. If you'd ask my wife, I'd probably act more like I'm getting ready to turn maybe 25. So I've been around a while. And when I was 31 years old, I had been on this pretty fortunate road of entrepreneurial success. And I was being recognized as the 26th fastest growing company in Utah. We had less than 20 full-time employees, and we had managed to take our company from $2 million in sales to almost $20 million in sales in less than 18 months.
And what kind of company was it?
Yeah, so it was a trade show and event company. So, you know, I know we're here at a, you know, at an event, at a conference. Yeah. So our company would build these big time booths. T-Mobile was our biggest client, you know, a multi-million dollar client. We did a lot of the kiosks that you see in the malls for T-Mobile. And, you know, on the outside, everyone would think, man, this guy has got it made. You know, I'm getting all these accolades. I'm making tons and tons and tons, more money than I thought I would ever make in a lifetime. I'm making in weeks. And so the more that I became successful and had the notoriety, and the more that I thought I had arrived, the more I noticed how unsettled I was and how... You know, even though I had dabbled with prescription medications here and there, you know, that backache maybe wasn't as bad as I made it seem. During the same time that I'm going through all this success, I'm also starting to struggle mightily with not only prescription medications, but I would go out on the weekends after being completely abstinent for, I hadn't tried anything for years and years and years. I'm going out to the clubs. I'm introduced to ecstasy and GHB and ketamine, and within 6 months of being abstinent, I was overdosing on almost a weekly basis. And GHB, if you know anything about that designer drug, it's very unpredictable with the body. So
you were overdosing on that.
I was overdosing a lot on club drugs, and then over time that escalated into a very big OxyContin habit. So OxyContin wasn't very, you know, it hadn't been on the market very long, so we didn't know really much about it. And I had a, you know, several thousand dollars a month was going into my OxyContin habit. And then that escalated into cocaine and dabbled in meth. And so when I talk about substance abuse, to me, it wasn't about the drug. It was about the escape. And it was all about fixing those feelings of, I wasn't ever going to be good enough. I was going to struggle with my own self-worth. And so rather than trying to even ask why I might have those issues with confidence and struggle, I just decided to fix those feelings. And I remember one of the things that really stands out about that time when I was having all this success was closing a deal with T-Mobile. And the moment that we walked out, this was a multi-million dollar deal. And when we walked out of the room, I looked over at one of my business partners and I'm like, how in the hell am I ever going to top that one? So I struggled with perfectionism. I struggled with just how I thought the world viewed me.
You couldn't enjoy it in the moment.
And I couldn't even enjoy it for 5 minutes. I was already thinking about, okay, now I got to figure out how to make, you know, the next 20 million. And that just, it perpetuated this fear that drove me to using habitually more and more and more. And then, of course, you know where the end of that story goes. I was in and out of treatment. I was on and off the streets. I was on suicide watch on several occasions, and I really didn't have a stop button. My stop button was either I ran out of money, I ran out of drugs, or I overdosed. And I'd wake up in a hospital room, I'd be incubated. And you know, everyone's heard those stories. And frankly, what I'd like to really switch gears on is share a lot more about how that transformation for me happened. So that went on. I lost that company, by the way. So we went from 26 fastest growing to filing bankruptcy within like 4 years. It was devastating, not only to me, but for all the other families and all the other employees, right? And you know, after losing that and now being destitute. So I remember the first time I went to treatment, I paid cash. You know, I just wrote him a check. I didn't even ask him when I showed up how much it was going to be, because at that point, money was not really that big of a deal for me. The second time I went through treatment, I had to be scholarshiped. And I was fortunate enough to have some friends that were able to help me get into a facility that helped me. But back and forth, you know, that whole roller coaster ride. And then, you know, I had this really interesting moment when I'd been clean for a little while. I was trying to put everything back together in my life. I was interviewing for some, you know, some high executive jobs, kind of that same lifestyle I'd been used to before. And I remember getting rejected. And this company, I went through 17 interviews. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to make it, you know, I'm going to get back on top again. And so I was really looking forward to this. I'm excited. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to change my life this time. And about 2 weeks later, I get the call that they decide to go a different way. And you know, when I didn't understand that it was really self-worth is what I was struggling
sure.
with.
Yeah.
I went off the deep end, and seriously, it went from 0 to 60. All of a sudden, next thing I know, I'm being chased down the road by several dozen police officers. And by the way, I don't remember any of this. This was all cited back to me by the judge. And somehow, some way, I didn't harm anyone. I don't know how. I don't know why. You know, you hear the stories about people who are driving under the influence that end up serving prison time because they killed somebody. That wasn't my experience, but it certainly could have been. And I remember coming to when I had about 50 guns to my head, just, you know, outside of my car in the middle of nowhere in you know, some little no-name town. And I became deeply suicidal because I thought, they're going to send me to prison for the next 30 years. And I just, in my own head, I couldn't even make sense of that. But for whatever reason, they allowed me to bail out. I had to borrow money from a friend to bail out. And then I went and I hid myself in a hotel for about a week, week and a half, because I just couldn't even imagine going to jail. I still knew that I was going to have to face the consequences. And so rather than doing that, I put a plan together. I wanted to take my own life. And And over a series of about 3 or 4 days, you know, as I'm kind of going through my head on how I'm going to do this and why I'm going to do it, and I need to just ease my own pain, you know, a couple of things emerged for me. One was, you know, I had 2 daughters at the time from my first marriage, and I just remember thinking about all the friends that I had had that had told me about when they had a parent that had taken their own life. And I couldn't bring myself to thinking about what I would put my daughters through. And I remember saying to myself, a deadbeat dad is better than a dead dad. And that, I know that sounds pathetic, but it kept me hanging on. My second kind of aha is there must be a reason why I'm even alive. Like, how have I gone through all of these overdoses and comas and heart attacks and everything that came with my drug use? How in the world was I still alive? There's got to be a reason. And over a 2-week period, I started to ask myself these really big questions around, how did I go from Mr. Super Overachiever, successful entrepreneur at the age of 31, multimillionaire, to lying, cheating, stealing, borrowing friends' cars, wondering where, you know, my next fix was going to come? And a light went off inside of me. And the first thing that I noticed is that the same thing that was driving me to be that overachiever was the very same thing that drove me to use, and that was fear. I was afraid of being rejected, which is why I went off so badly when I was rejected from that company. I had no real sense of self. And so to me, becoming that great salesperson was more about survival than it was about being successful. It was more about me needing people to accept me, and so I would go above and beyond to try to get that acceptance.
So that was like just another coping mechanism at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, the difference of those two scenarios though is I'm getting, you know, I'm getting reinforcement, I'm getting pats on the back.
Yeah.
You know, you're the most awesome salesperson, yeah, blah 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 blah, right? Whereas on the other side, it's, you know, I'm ostracized. And but that insight led me then down a path of really trying to understand why I didn't think so highly of myself. I think so many times people, when they go down the path of recovery and they're trying to kind of figure out how to live their life, we just replace one addiction for another. The difference is that addiction may be working out, or it may be working in the industry, or it may be becoming a therapist, or losing yourself in something. I'm not so sure that is the best way to approach recovery. I think real recovery is where you have a sense of freedom that you've addressed whatever it was that was driving that behavior in the first place. So I don't want to get mixed up in disease concept or any of that. That's not even for me to talk about. All I can talk about is my own experience and how when I had a transformation and saw myself differently, I no longer needed to fix those feelings of inadequacy or self-worth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think at the core of it, you were talking about, you know, the happiness, the well-being. If you're healthy, like emotionally healthy, mentally healthy, then you're not going to need whatever that other stuff is, right? That's like, you know, you say, like finding your identity, finding yourself. So it doesn't matter if your addiction's working out, you can still work out, but it doesn't have to be that addiction if you're finding your identity or your well-being in who you are, as opposed to doing this thing.
Yeah, in fact, it reminds me. So yesterday, I was speaking here at the conference here at Innovations, and I was talking a little bit about my story and sharing with people that, you know, I became charismatic and I became very animated and passionate as a survival mechanism. And someone in the audience is like, "Well, yeah, but aren't you doing that right now?" And my response to that was, yeah, but it's coming from the inside out, not the outside in. I'm not doing out of survival. I've literally embraced who I am in such a way that this is what you see is what you get. You know, I come from a place that is more authentic and more real, and people really resonate with that. And so a lot of times it's not about looking at the end result. It's about finding out where is that really coming from.
Let's get into your presentation that you gave here at the conference. Innate Listening was the title, Cultivating an Environment for better outcomes and transformation. So let's start by having you kind of define what's this concept of innate listening? What does that mean to you?
So innate listening was a term that my wife and I created. We started out about 7-8 years ago. When I had my own transformation, I was fascinated with personal development and leadership training and maybe some even the science behind how does that all work. And so I became a student of my own experience. And really, I became a researcher of that. And one of the things that I noticed is I used to hear people say this all the time. Well, you've got to create this safe environment for people. You got to, you know, it's got to be a safe environment. You hear this from therapists. You hear this from people in the industry. And my question is, okay, so how do you do that? Like, is it just a set of special circumstances that show up? Or can you deliberately provide the kind of environment that feels safe to other people? And so 9 years ago, when I was really exploring this and going deeper into that, one of the things that my wife and I stumbled on was a term called polyvagal theory. Okay. So I know it's a big word.
Unpack it. Yeah.
Right. All right. Polyvagal theory comes from a neuroscientist by the name of Dr. Stephen Porges. And Dr. Porges, he was working with a lot of veterans. And what his theory was is that if something happens in our body automatically without us being conscious about it when we are in survival mode. For instance, if a bear all of a sudden jumped through the wall at us, what would happen to your body?
You'd be like fight or flight or whatever you call it. You'd tense up, you'd run.
Right. So, but there are some physical manifestations.
Oh, like adrenaline.
Right? Yeah. So yeah. Adrenaline, heart rate, we sweat and we react like that. We even, you know, fast twitch muscles will kick in and you're probably jumping under the table without even thinking about
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what Dr. Porges theorized is that if something is happening on that end of the spectrum when we're in fight or flight, I wonder what's happening to the body without us even recognizing it when we're in safety. And the more that he did the research and started to work with a lot of veterans with PTSD, what he noticed is that absolutely, some things were going on in the body that we weren't even aware of when we started to feel safe, when we'd let down our guard. And I'll give you a great example, and we've all experienced this. So you walk into a busy restaurant, it's super noisy, you can't hear a thing from whoever is in your party, right? But then you sit down, you start having a conversation, and what happens to all that ambient noise?
Starts to get turned down a little bit.
It disappears, right? So what you and I probably didn't know before I talk about this is that there is a little bone in your ear that when you start to feel safe, it tunes in and focuses into the person in front of you. So think about that for a minute. The reason that we need that peripheral hearing is because if some kind of threat comes in, we need to be aware of that, right? So the moment that you feel safe, do you need that anymore?
Doesn't need it anymore, yeah.
So we're talking about the kind of safety where you literally, not only do you let down your guard consciously, but unconsciously your body settles down in such a state that it opens you up to new conversations. It opens you up to connect with the person across from you. It opens you up to new thought and to creativity, which is just another fancy way of saying it opens you up to insight.
Yeah, yeah. And so how do you describe the importance of listening in this context? Like, why is that such a vital part of the whole thing?
Yeah, so when we started to look at this, one of the things that my wife and I noticed as we collaborated a lot on this was, you know, most of us, we have a conversation and we're listening not with the intent to understand what the other person is saying, but we're listening to respond. So I'm trying to come up with, you know, I'm going to come up with a really smart answer, right, to whatever you're saying, or I'm going to make sure that they hear this piece. And so what happens is we're really not even having a conversation with the other person. We're having a conversation with ourselves and just picking up bits and pieces of what they're saying with the idea that we're going to respond and look smart and we're going to be the one with all the answers. And so we started out calling it deep listening, but the more research we did, we found that that was a term that a lot of people used. And we knew that if we wanted to get people's attention, we needed to shift the narrative a little bit. So we came up with this idea of innate listening. Now, the word innate itself is just another way of saying natural, automatic. It's already built into the system. So here's very simply put how innate listening works. So number one is to see the person for who they are, not for what they've done, not for their history, not for how they look, not for how they act, but to see them for who they really are. And in other words, be present, be right here, be in the moment with somebody. Number two is to listen with empathy and compassion. And one of the examples I use in that, I think most people get that in general terms, but when you start thinking about walking in somebody else's shoes, we've always heard that as a term, right? Oh yeah, you need to walk in someone else's shoes to understand. But I think there's a missing piece to that term, and it is walk in their shoes from their perspective, not from yours.
Yeah, so you're not bringing your experience, your preconceived notions into their shoes and saying like, oh, this isn't that bad, or whatever it might be.
Yeah, so I mean, just think of the narrative that we tell ourselves as, you know, I'm going to try to understand you, but I'm coming from my perspective and trying to understand that. Well, that doesn't work. You know, you're putting a filter on. And yes, it's impossible for me to walk in your shoes from your perspective, but what if I just had a mindset to try? You know, when I start to understand a little bit more about you, and here's what I've come to learn myself, and I don't know if you've ever heard this term, but there was a term that I heard growing up most of my life, and it was, to know someone is to love them. And that takes on a whole nother meaning, because here's what I've learned. When I do really take the time to try to understand you and your perspective from your eyes, from your viewpoint, I can't help but love you, because all of a sudden I get to see your true self. And, you know, we hear terms like vulnerability and authenticity, and maybe you can check this with your own experience, but when we really do get to see someone for them, what is always the reaction? Man, I really like that person. Oh my gosh, I just connected with them in such a way. So this idea of listening with empathy and compassion is really goes back to that idea of, if when I get to know you, I'm going to love you, because we were built to connect. We were built to really know each other. So that's number two. Number three is to let go of judgments. And to really allow for yourself to, rather than form an opinion or go into a conversation with somebody with the idea that I think I already know where they're coming from, but to you know, a simple way to say it is just be curious. So that's another piece. And then the big one, here's the big kicker, and I always love watching when I'm teaching either admissions or marketing teams, or I'm teaching therapists this concept, and when I come out with this last one, this differentiates all other types of listening, and it is to not give advice or feedback. And a therapist might be thinking, well, that's my job. Yeah. Here's the point. When you drill down and you start talking about everyone's perspective, there is nothing I can say that will ever change your mind. You have to see it for yourself. And so really my job is to point you in the direction and to let you see that. And the moment, and I'll take my own experience. My parents told me they loved me every day of my life growing up. I didn't believe it. Deep down, I had a belief system that said I'm not lovable. I was full of guilt and shame.
Yeah, you didn't have your self-worth.
So even my parents every single day telling me they loved me was not enough. I had to see it for myself. So the moment that I was in the safe enough environment to not feel judged, and where I could just be, and frankly, it was very serendipitous. At this point, my parents had kind of given up on me being anything other than the deadbeat that I had shown up as. And so they dropped all expectations. Well, guess what that created for me? A safe environment. So the idea of innate listening really is truly step-by-step understanding that creating the kind of environment that's free of labels, that's free of expectation, that's free of advice or even any feedback, it opens me up automatically based on polyvagal theory that all of a sudden I'm going to be open to a new conversation, and it allows me to be more creative and gain new insights on myself and the world around me.
Yeah, and not feeling that pressure to, oh, you want to respond and seem smart, but even like you want to respond and like, help, or like, I'm going to be the fixer. Okay, I've heard what you have to say. I have the solution for you. It's not about that either, right?
No, that's right. And you know, here's a debate that I think typically, so I'm married. My wife and I have been together for almost 11 years. And I can tell you from even that experience, when she's sharing something with me, she doesn't need me to fix anything. She just wants to feel heard. And frankly, I think every human being wants that. We want to feel heard. We want to be acknowledged that somebody took the time to just be with me for a minute. I mean, think of what's going on with social media and how disconnected we feel, because that I call it the junk food of social, you know, of connection. You know, it feels good for a minute, but it's not really fulfilling that deeper connection that I think we all long for.
Yeah, I'm going to get some quick likes. That's like a bag of French fries. Yeah.
Right? Yeah, so yeah, it's like, oh my gosh, that tastes really good right now. And then 10 minutes later, you're like, why didn't I get more of that? Right? It's that sugar high. And being heard and deeply connecting with someone is such a game changer in every single one of our relationships. I can't even tell you what's happened over the last 11 years of me practicing this more and more every single day. The relationship I have with my kids, my wife, my parents, you know, the people around me, it's like I see the world differently today because of the way that I choose to show up as a listener, you know, of really wanting to gain a better understanding of who you are.
You touched on this a little bit, but the idea is, you know, instead of, you know, maybe offering that solution, jumping back in with advice, so not doing that, but you still want to guide or lead somehow, especially in this kind of treatment context. You want to guide whoever you're listening to that aha moment, right? To them feeling empowered. So how does that work? How does that go about?
Yeah, so I talk a lot about following that nudge. So it really, again, it comes from, so this is where that listening to another person can be applicable to yourself, where you start to listen to that inner guidance system that I call it, or you're that deeper intelligence inside of you, to just know when to ask a particular question. So, and this works, by the way, not only with therapists, but it works with admissions and marketing as well. I mean, if you're on the phone with somebody, even though you may get 100 calls and every call may seem similar to another one, every single call is unique in its own way. And handling that is different for every single situation. And so I invite people to not only listen to others this way, but listen to yourself, that, you know, that deeper part of you that some call gut feeling or intuition. And what starts to happen is if you're present, if you're listening with empathy and compassion, if you're not judging what's coming up, and you have the courage or the openness to follow that, it's going to guide you in such a way that you'll be able to navigate that. And then you're co-creating with your clients. You're co-creating with that mom who's calling you on the phone that's frantic about, what do I do? So it works with people out there, but my greatest value with it is me using it with myself.
Yeah. And so kind of in this world, what are some things that you wish more people in healthcare, specifically behavioral healthcare, what are some things you wish they understood about listening, about, you know, the value of that, about how to do it better?
There's a quote, something that goes around the road to success and the road to failure is so small, and I think we fall into this trap of thinking we know, and we really don't know. And I use that especially with listening, because I'll get people going, oh yeah, it's just like, you know, active listening, or it's just like this, and it's not. There is, you know, let's use a sports metaphor, because that's an easy one for people to compare, but, you know, you think about a professional sports team that goes undefeated, and you think about a professional sports team that loses every single game, And I'm telling you, the difference between those two teams is inches.
Well, yeah, they're both full of professional athletes. So they're already top of the heap. Yeah.
But it's this slight little, I mean, let's use it, Michael Jordan. I think everybody on the planet probably knows that name. Michael Jordan just did a few things slightly different than anyone else that's ever played that catapulted him into another stratosphere. But it was slight. It wasn't like big things. And I think that we get so used to, oh, we went to school and I got my master's and then I got my PhD, and we think we know. And so if I could boil it down, I would like to see more curiosity, because that will drive innovation, which we lack a ton of in this industry. If we want to have a real talk about, you know, what changes have really been made in our industry, there's not a whole lot, because we've just kind of gotten stuck in this old way of thinking, like every industry does, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, we didn't know the taxi business was so outdated until Uber showed up. And now who uses a taxi anymore? So a lot of times we don't even know what we don't know, right? And so we just think that, well, a taxi's fine, it'll get us there. The way in the state of our industry today is we're just getting by. Let's be honest, the numbers aren't that great. Outcomes, we can't even decide on what the outcomes need to be tracked, right? And so I would love to just see more curiosity. I'd love to see people ask questions like, well, why does it need to be a 30-day program? Or why RTC over this way? Or why can't telehealth be more involved? Or I don't know, but I think curiosity could help us leapfrog some of the stagnant progress that's been non-existent, I think, for years.
And it's such an important mission. It seems like, okay, yeah, like that's worth it. Like we should do that.
Yeah, but I think we get comfortable. You know, I think we're just getting by, and we're not asking. I think we need to ask better questions, you know, and explore that, collaborate more. But I think curiosity would solve, believe it or not, I think that would solve all of it. I think if we just started not thinking we knew everything, because we're not even close. Not even close. We're missing the mark.
Yeah.
We know there are 23 million people in the United States, according to the Surgeon General from the 2016 report, that they were somehow able to come up with this number, about 23 million people that need help. I think that's grossly under the real number, because you have to remember, that's got to be people who are actually saying that they...
Admitting.
Admitting it. But even with that number, only 10% are getting any treatment. So we have less than 10% of the United States that's struggling with a substance use disorder that are even getting help. And my big question to the industry is, why? Like, what's going... We are missing something, I think, significant, when we can only serve less than 10% of a population that is struggling mightily. I mean, this isn't bad credit. We're talking about lives on the line, and only 10% are getting help. We are missing something, I think, pretty significant.
Yeah, and it's not, like you just mentioned, it's not a demand problem. Like, I mean, you think about another industry. If there was like 10% of people who want cheeseburgers were getting cheeseburgers, like the cheeseburger industry would figure that out. They'd get more cheeseburgers to more people.
Yeah. And I think it's a combination of a lot of things, right? But you're exactly right. And here's the thing. It's a recession-proof type of product, right, that we're offering, because people are just struggling. It doesn't matter how much money they're making. I mean, there's just no, you know, there's no real indicators here. I just think it just... the problem is ever evolving, and yet we don't seem to really be listening to what's happening well enough to address it and to actually help more people.
All right. Well, just wrap up with this final question. You know, everyone who serves in this industry, it's very personal. Obviously, it's very personal to you with your journey to get up and fight for this cause every day. So could we end by just having you sum up, you know, why this mission matters to you?
I personally don't want people to feel as alone as I did. And so anything I can do to offer support or help or insight so people are still reminded that they matter and that they're not alone is, and I don't know how that needs to look. I don't even care, but I know that that is absolutely my purpose. And I remember 11 years ago, January 16th, I wrote in a journal that has since been burned in a fire. Another story, another day. But I remember writing in that journal, I knew I had purpose. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what that was going to look like, but I knew I had purpose. Today, I know what that purpose is, and it is to help people know that they're not alone and that they absolutely matter, and they deserve all the joy and happiness and well-being that life has to offer, and it's right there for them. And so whether that's speaking at a conference to a bunch of therapists to hopefully inspire them or provide them with some knowledge around how they can do that better, that fulfills my mission. If it's me being present as a dad, that fulfills my mission because I got 9 kids.
Oh my goodness.
I know, right?
Wow. Okay.
And being there for them so they don't have to question their value is vitally important to me. So it across the board, but I know absolute connection is key, and that's absolutely what I'm here for.
James Hadlock is a former multi-million dollar entrepreneur who's now using his transformed life and recovery to teach others about the ways meaningful connection can impact business, family, and personal success. You can learn more about Blue Novus, the human connection company he founded in the Salt Lake City area of Utah, at blunovus.com. As always, this podcast is powered by Foundations Recovery Network and produced, written, and edited by me, David Kondos. If you haven't yet, be sure to connect with us on social media to get a look at what we have coming up. We're on Facebook at Recovery Unscripted Podcast and on Twitter at Recov Unscripted. Thanks for listening, and I hope to see you right back here for the next episode of Recovery Unscripted.